You're listening to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Angela Davis's speech at the University of Michigan Monday drew an overflow crowd to Ann Arbor. The renowned writer, activist, and academic encouraged her audience to remember the perspectives on history that may not be represented in a mainstream record.
The agents of history are not so much the leaders and the spokespeople, but rather the masses of people who develop a collective imagination regarding the possibility of a new future.
Davis's story, including her imprisonment and exoneration related to a courthouse occupation in 1970, has inspired many people. We were interested to learn that one of the university events scheduled around her appearance was a storytelling session on the costs of activism. One of those who told the story Monday was Vidya Aravind. For the past 4 years, she's been involved in a range of progressive causes, from anti-war rallies while tensions with Iran were high, to LGBTQ and trans rights issues, to labor organizing. She told us the cost has been real for her. How did you start to get politically active? What set you on your path?
Coming out as trans and being a trans woman of color will automatically do a lot of work to radicalize you, because if you kind of want you and your communities to stay alive, you learn a lot about what you and your communities go through very quickly. And so I came out in March of 2016, picked a great year for it. And then I was doing a lot of like educational work mostly, not necessarily something that people would think of when they think of activism. But then November 2016 happened and I felt like I had to get involved. I felt like the kinds of education I was doing didn't feel like enough, or they were shifting things quickly. And so I dug around on Facebook, and there was a student group called Students for Justice, and I was friends with some of them. They seemed pretty radical, and they were organizing a rally for the next week in defense of DACA after Trump got elected. And so I joined in on that organizing effort, and that's sort of how I first got involved, and it was just a lot of organizing after that. Just kind of jumped in the deep end.
Can you give us a range of some of the issues that you've done work on?
Sure. I've done labor organizing, police accountability organizing, trans health and trans community building, racial justice on campus, very active in the campaign to stop Richard Spencer from speaking here, recently helped out in Benton Harbor with the high school closing. I participated in all of the lame duck work that was happening around 2018.
The March 15th climate strike.
I was involved in that.
How does one go from one issue? I mean, intersectionality hardly seems to cover what it is you've been doing.
Sure. It very much is a feeling of like same struggle, same fight. It's not necessarily about seeing the ways that all of them are very specifically connected. It's more that, you know, none of us are free until all of us are free. And I kind of have a unique ability to do like networking and coalition building and some amount of communication work, group facilitation, group mediation, those sorts of things. So I try and bring those to spaces that seem like they need them. And anytime there's like a large coalitional effort in the area, I try and involve myself and help however I can. Rather than thinking of them as distinct issues, I think the way I see it is that like I'm trying to build or participate in a culture of organizing and care that is very inclusive and that brings people in and starts to build a much bigger movement. So I don't see each campaign or rally or project as individual. I see it as part of a very, very large project to build political consciousness and a want for change.
So Vidya, Angela Davis was in town over the weekend to give a speech and encourage people to think deeply about their activism. I don't know that we're ever going to get this question answered by her, but if you could ask her one question, what would it be?
I think I would ask her what her perspective on losing is, because my understanding as an organizer, and I think a lot of the understandings that lots of people have around me, is that like, especially in kind of work to counter existent structures of power, a lot of what we do is losing. And like the way I've thought about it for myself, to make myself like not focus on each individual loss and like, I guess, feel the brutality of it, is that through each losing effort, I'm still building relationships. I'm still educating people. People are still coming together. People are still working hard. That momentum carries forward, even if the individual project doesn't. But it's just so many losses all the time. Electorally, not electorally, anytime you're trying to change structures of power, there's always really, really intense resistance. There's always lots of compromising. So I think I would ask her about that. I would also ask her about how she sees the importance of mutual aid work and like what kind of creative ways that she has to kind of approach and think about mutual aid work, because I think that's, especially in this era of Trump getting elected, a lot of activism focus goes to like our elected officials and goes to trying to change structures of power, and not necessarily a lot goes to building the community resources and the community care we need so that we don't have to rely on those same structures of power. Mutual aid work was very, very important to the Black Panther Party and to a lot of the groups working in the 60s and 70s. And I would be curious how she sees mutual aid work today, if she sees it as like comparable or like if she sees it as like having dropped off, and what are ways she would like to approach it and think about it.
Getting back for a moment to your question about how to cope with, you know, being on the losing side of things, what has been your way of getting through that?
I really, really try and focus on a longer timeline, the kinds of ways I can build towards something in the distant future. And I also try and focus on kind of understanding scale and scope, especially for losing efforts or for things that, you know, feel bad. We hear about them on like national or international scales all the time. But like even people in Washtenaw County don't know about the efforts I'm doing, for example, to host relationship skills workshops and to teach queer people about how to be in relationship better with each other so that when we need to rely on each other, we can and we haven't burnt those bridges. There are tiny efforts like that happening all over the world, all over the country. And so I keep trying to remind myself that like I don't know about all the people fighting everywhere, and I just sort of have to have trust and faith that there are lots of people fighting everywhere in spite of all of these big, big losses and big, big existential crises we're facing. And then I try and focus on like, what does the long game look like? What does it look like to kind of build relationships so that we can care for each other 10, 15, 20 years down the road, even if we lose an electoral fight now?
Are there ways that your life in activism has colored your interactions with other people?
Yeah. So when I first came out as trans, I was very much this kind of, I don't know, very aggressive trans woman of color. I thought I knew everything. I thought I didn't have time for people who didn't know the things that I knew. I didn't really have a good conception of solidarity. And then,
I'm sorry, like what kinds of things?
Like if people hadn't had social justice education before, I wasn't interested in spending time with them. If people like were saying the wrong things in spaces I was in, I was very invested in correcting them. And I was very invested in like everyone needs to be on the exact same page. And the way everyone gets on the exact same page is by me sharing that page with everyone all the time. And like something I learned over time is that you don't build power by being correct. You build power by being in relationship with people, building love and trust. And then when that love and trust exists, they'll learn from you without your having to put effort into it. I think a big example of this is the police accountability work I did in Ann Arbor when that task force was happening to establish the commission that exists now. I am a police and prison abolitionist, right? So like if I had it my way, the work wouldn't have been for police accountability. I don't think police accountability is a thing that functionally works because police themselves are a very oppressive system and the accountability doesn't fix that. It doesn't fix what like the nature and mission of policing is. And so if I had it my way, the activism would have been to like disarm cops or divest from cops or, you know, make less than a third of the city budget cops. But the community and especially Black elders after Aura Rosser's murder at the hands of police really, really wanted police accountability. Like if I went into that space and was just like attempting to be correct or attempting to push police abolition more than just offering it and seeing if people will take it, then I wouldn't have made friends. I wouldn't have been in solidarity with people. I wouldn't have built relationships.
And you maybe wouldn't have heard them.
Right, exactly. And that summer was rough because I was working to fix police, which is work that I don't believe in, but I was working to build relationships through that work. And then at the end of the day, things panned out in such a way that the commission is like not at all what we wanted. Many of us suspect that it won't be able to actually hold police accountable in the ways we wanted, even if we wanted police accountability. It sort of panned out that the fight on the surface was like a loss. But I now have relationships with Black elders in the community who I respect and learn from and who respect and learn from me and who I can talk to about issues and those relationships are the actual work that doing this police accountability task force was. And when I first came out, and maybe for the first year and a half of being out, that wasn't something I understood well. But now I really see the goal of any activism is to build care and build relationships, and then you can grow together after that.
Would you say that activism has come with some personal costs for you?
Yeah, personal costs. I think the costs aren't from like activism or the nature of activism itself. I think costs are from the ways that activism exists in our society and the ways that we talk and think about activism. Because like, I don't want to dissuade anyone from getting involved, right? Even though like a lot of getting involved hurts and is hard. And I think that only talking about costs without talking about like what we get out of it or how those costs can change in the future and aren't necessarily permanent things is an important thing to do. I think people don't realize that activism is a practice skill. People see you on stage or see you in front of the room or see you facilitating the meeting and don't see the work that you've done to develop those skills. And so because they don't see the work that you've done to develop those skills, they assume that they can't do it and that you can do it. And then the same kinds of work keeps falling to the same kinds of people, particularly women of color in activist spaces. In that way, activism becomes less sustainable. It becomes less of a thing that we can do for a long time. We're not developing new activists. And something I dealt with a lot in my first 2 or 3 years of activism was a lot of burnout because I kept on taking things that were either falling to me or that I felt and was sort of, I guess, kind of conditioned to feel by the ways we think and talk about activism that were like my job or my role.
What do you think it is that makes the difference between people who do step forward to become activists and people who don't? Is it a question of wanting it more?
I don't know what wanting it more quite means. I think it's a question of people who don't talk themselves out of doing it. There's a lot of fear and apprehension of getting it wrong, especially when like lives and marginalized communities are at stake.
And people are outside their comfort zone. Let's just say it. And when white people or straight people are outside their comfort zone.
Yeah, absolutely. So there's a fear of getting it wrong. There's a fear of failure. People do a lot of mental work to talk themselves either out of doing things or to talk themselves into believing that the things they're doing are enough. I think we can always not necessarily be doing more in the sense that we should always be burnt out, but we can always be finding more creative ways to like build community, build care, build relationships, and to do more political work. The thing that I've noticed in myself that helps me get involved, it's not quite that I don't have a fear of failure. I do have a fear of failure and I have a fear of getting it wrong. But like I have very little forethought, but in a very positive and useful way, where I don't spend a lot of time on the front end thinking about what the results will be or thinking about what like failure looks like or why it shouldn't be me. I just think about what are the things I'm good at or what are the things I can bring to this space. And then I just do it and then learn from the consequences after the fact. A lot of activism, like I said, is failure and losing. And a lot of activism has to look like creatively throwing spaghetti at the wall and seeing what sticks. And I think a lot of people are kind of afraid to kind of jump in and try new things and step out of their comfort zone to develop the kinds of skills that we don't learn in school. We don't learn how to facilitate coalitional meetings in high school. And the only way we learn these things is by doing. So I think the thing that happens is there are a handful of people who get this practice because they jump in, and then there are a handful of people who talk themselves out of things, and the people who get the practice become good at things because of the practice and then do things over and over and over and over again.
What keeps you going?
I think what keeps me going is I get a lot of fulfillment from the ways that people tell me that they felt cared for by me, either things I've done or mutual aid projects I've done, or when people say they've learned something from me, or when people have like built relationships because I connected people that needed to be connected. I get a lot of fulfillment from people seeing me as providing some sort of worthy guidance. And that's the kind of thing that keeps me going. And that's the kind of work that I'm trying to do more and more of, is kind of facilitation and coaching and mediation and the kinds of things that help people grow and help people reflect and help people learn. I think something that's true of organizers is that when they jump in, they do everything. And it turns out that we're allowed to like have things we like and don't like. So like, it took me 2 years to realize that I shouldn't take on logistical tasks at all because they just make me miserable. and now I try and like push other people to take on the works of like scheduling or booking or finding food or these kinds of things. And I pick the role that I get the most fulfillment out of, which is watching people around me grow.
Is there a place, are there places that you can go where you're not the activist in the room?
Sometimes. It's hard. That's another, I think, another cost of activism that we can talk about is like people's and even friends' perceptions of me kind of color the ways that I share space with people. But the ways I decompress are basically I have a lot of very close friendships and relationships, and I just spend time with them in like one-on-one or small group capacities doing very low-stakes things that have nothing to do with work and nothing to do with checking emails and nothing to do with scheduling meetings.
Such as?
Like to play board games, like to watch TV, like to just sit around my friends and read. Very, very kind of casual, chill, low-investment things that I do. And the people I do them with are also all political people. The people I share space with are all people who, in some degree or another, either because they're marginalized themselves or because they're organizers themselves or often both, kind of understand the stress that I go through. And that makes it a lot easier to share space with them. And so kind of sharing space with people and using the relationships I've built up is what I do to decompress.
Actually, I don't know, maybe that would be the closer. Was there anything that we didn't talk about that you think is important to touch on?
Yeah, so the kind of cost of activism I mentioned about perception, right? So in addition to people perceiving me as some sort of having some sort of special or unique skill set that they can't achieve and thus work falls to me, people also perceive, like, people tend to put organizers on pedestals, and there's this kind of culture of celebrity organizing that I think really started, as far as I noticed, out of Ferguson and some of the Ferguson organizers who, like,
the Black Lives Matter movement. Mm-hmm,
and the people who stepped up got pedestaled for stepping up. And what that pedestalizing does is that, like, sometimes when I show up in spaces and just want to be at a space or be someone's friend, people look at me and see me as somehow more than them in a way that doesn't feel comfortable. I've had people tell me, like, that they're intimidated by all of the good things they see me doing in the world. And that's not a thing I want. I want to be as approachable as anyone else. And I want to be, you know, have as easy of a time making friends as anyone else does. And it usually takes people some time spent with me to kind of learn who I actually am. But because a lot of the work I've done historically has been very public, people have this impression of what I am that needs to be deconstructed before they can actually build a relationship with me.
That sounds exhausting.
It is, and also it's sort of the nature of the thing, in a way that, like, I don't mind, but I do wish more people thought about critically.
Vidya, thank you so much for coming in and talking to us.
Thanks for having me. This was great.
That's Vidya Aravind. Tomorrow, we'll hear from a conservative activist who's experienced some similar social costs for activism and how she's dealt with them.